You're listening to Sound Forms, Conversations with Composers, and I'm your host, Peter Wetzler. In this episode, we are featuring the music of and conversations with Kirk Nurock, a wonderful pianist, composer, and natural sound and cross-species musical explorer. This is our first show of non-Hudson Valley residents, but hey, many of us migrated up here from the boroughs, and there are still a few stragglers left in New York City that haven't discovered the promised land. So I'm going to spend the summer featuring some New York composers, and we'll travel a bit further downtown to hang out with Lori Spiegel next month. I first met Kirk when I was transitioning from a classical piano career to writing music for postmodern dance, and I went to him for jazz piano lessons and ended up singing with his natural sound ensemble in the late 70s. I want to start with a cut from the trio album of the music of Kirk Nurock, released in 1997, called Remembering Tree Friends, and then give you a sample of the 1982 LP on the Virgo label called Natural Sound, which Kirk will be speaking about later on in the hour.
Thank you.
And that was Rhythm Chant from side one of Kirk Nurok's 1982 Natural Sound album. I say side one because it is yet to be released as a CD. And in case our younger audience is not part of the return to vinyl trend, I thought I'd preface that back in the Paleolithic 80s, we listened to music primarily on albums that had two sides. And there's actually a piece on side two called Rhythm Chant, which I'll play later. Before that, we heard the cut Tiny Dancer on the 1997 CD with our guest composer Kirk Nurok on piano, Harvey Schwartz on bass, and Bobby Previtt on drums. So let's fade in now on our conversation with Kirk Nurok.
As we were sitting at the recording, I'm thinking about that recording we did in that school. It was like the first digital recording. We spent the whole morning trying to find a fan that was coming out in the recording. Like, it was, and it ended up being in some other part of the building. And we'd never worked with equipment that was that sensitive. Well, start before that. What's the cliff notes of Kirk Nurok?
What a memory that is, by the way, of that moment. Yeah. I can almost recall it, how long we had to wait. We were like already in sort of young people who aren't used to that kind of patience. Yeah. You know, I was a child prodigy as a kid, and my dad was a stage parent, and I was on national television when I was 12 and 13 years old playing jazz piano. My dad, though an optometrist by trade, was an amateur jazz pianist, and we had a piano in the house, and we had Mead Lux Lewis records and Art Tatum, and Teddy Wilson was a favorite of his, and all 78s, of course. And I always remember waiting for my hand to grow large enough that I could reach a 10th, because I wanted to play like stride thing. It took a lot of years, of course, from 9 years old or something. But and then I studied, still before Juilliard even, I studied in New York with a couple of jazz teachers, one of whom was Johnny Richards, who was a big band arranger, composer who wrote for the Kenton Band a lot. And I started writing big band music, which was my passion all through high school. I wrote like this biggest stack of big band charts, and that was about a foot high. An older cousin of mine gave me as a present a recording of Bartok, of the music for strings, percussion, and celeste. The first classical music I'd heard. I thought, what was that?
Isn't that amazing? How old were you when you heard that?
First, I want to backtrack. It wasn't the first classical music I heard. It was the first 20th century modern music. Of course, I'd heard Mozart and Beethoven. I was probably 13 or 14. Yeah. And I thought, wow, I want to write like that weird stuff. And a short while thereafter, my dad, who was a wonderful, great father, who just kind of, the older I get, the more I appreciate how much he supported me as a young artist and let me do my thing and helped encourage it. And at the time, Milton Babbitt and Gunther Schuller were both on the faculty at Princeton. We lived in Trenton. And there was this little evening for new music that about this little 6 or 8 piece ensemble. He saw how much I loved this, and he somehow found that in the paper. He didn't really know who they were, but contemporary music at Princeton University. I'll bet my kid's going to like that. So we drove to Princeton, and a very young Gunther Schuller was playing French horn in it. I remember it to this day. And Babbitt was on the faculty. I think a couple of his pieces were performed, although he wasn't a performer. And a small ensemble played, and I was hooked. Just, it was like, enough of jazz. I wanted to do the strange stuff. Yeah. But of course, jazz has always stayed with me. But I wanted to go to Juilliard, especially because Purser Kenny was there. Purser Kenny was very well known in the area where I grew up because he's from Philadelphia and I was from Trenton. He was sort of the American Nadia Boulanger, if you will, of the day. He was known to be a great composition teacher. And so I had the great fortune of studying with him for about four and a half of my 6 years at Juilliard.
I have to ask, what made him, because, you know, I studied with Milton Babbitt, and I did not have a great experience studying with him. In fact, he kind of led me away from 20th century music, and I started writing music for choreographers. But I had an experience one day where I heard Sun Ra for the first time, and I had my composition lesson the next day with Milton, and I said, I heard Sun Ra, and it was amazing. And he said, Peter, what was it you heard? If you can't put it in words, it's nonsense. And there was his Wittgensteinian logic right there. And I said, well, I'll listen some more, because I was stoned or something the night before. Yeah. And I said, I'll listen again, and I'll get back to you. I would spend months on two measures of a Mozart piano sonata. We would dissect and analyze what Mozart was able to do in two measures and then extend out into a sonata form. The end product of that kind of study for me was I would write two measures of music, and I got so stifled. So anyhow, what was great about studying with Purser Kenny and how he taught as a mentor?
One parenthetical question, if I may, because I forget this. Did you go to Princeton? Is that where you started with Babbitt? Wow, of course, yeah. Wow, I'd forgotten that. Skip LaPlante went to Princeton. And it's coming back to me now.
Yeah, yes, and Bob Helps was my piano teacher. He was the one that saved me. Now, did you know Bob?
I never met him, but I have at least one very good friend who studied with him for years and
Don
loved
Salmon,
him.
Right?
But Don Salmon also studied with him. That's exactly right. Although who I was thinking of was Bill Comico studied with Robert.
Oh, Bill!
Helps.
Yes.
Yes, do you know? Yeah. Purser Kenny, it's first of all, he was just a totally engaging, accessible, humor-filled individual. You walked in and he was happy. He was happy to see you. He had a funny joke. He was quick. He had quips. He was just delightful. And especially when I first went to Juilliard, I hadn't really, when I was like 18, whatever you are, as a freshman, I hadn't really known adult artists much. I knew some local jazz musicians, but I never knew a distinguished individual who was an art. I mean, he was such a role model, just that there was so much fun and life in him, and he was so creative. But to get more to the point of your question, he seemed to know things on a very detailed level about motivic growth and development, and about how a phrase of music expresses itself. Where is its heart? Where is the interesting beat and a half that you would choose to develop? He understood things about how long a thematic idea might go on before it gets a little old, where it needs a variation, or if it's too soon for a variation. He used to have this saying, it either needs less about more or more about less. And what he meant by that, in my teaching, I've translated that into different words, but it's the same idea. I call it contrast versus continuity. But it's his idea. It's just that the more about less wording, it's perhaps a bit confusing, so I don't use it, but it was very clear to me when he was saying it. He said, at a given point in the piece, when you don't know where to go next, either you need more development about fewer ideas, you need fewer ideas and more development, that's more about less, or you need less development about more ideas. Well, my goodness, just that one insight, that one way of helping you navigate from one juncture, like imagine you're a minute and a half or 2 minutes into a piece of music, to the next, is so deep. And what also used to always strike me was that his students didn't sound anything like each other. Because, of course, who studied with him by the time I got there were Charles Warnin, both Steve Reich and Philip Glass. There was a violinist whose name is...
Let's fade out on our conversation with Kirk Nurock for a moment and hear a sample of his teacher Vincent Persichetti's music. This is part of the opening movement of the Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, played by Robert Taub, who was actually a classmate of mine at Princeton, although we never knew each other. And he's playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, directed by Charles Dutoit. ¶¶ We've just heard a live town hall recording from 1990 of our guest Kirk Nurok playing his composition entitled Gorilla Gorilla, preceded by his teacher Vincent Persichetti, who may be rolling in his grave by my not playing the piano concerto in its entirety. Forgive me, Vincent, but I wanted to focus on your illustrious student, Kirk, and we've only got an hour, so let's fade back in on our conversation with Kirk Nurok. Yeah.
You could list eight of his students and they sounded nothing like each other. What that told me was he understood these, if it doesn't seem too grandiose, these sort of eternal compositional truths of some sort, and he could apply it to anything he brought in, really.
Yeah.
I mean, even among my own student colleagues, Bill Schimmel and Bill Carmichael and Tom Pearson and Paul Levy and a handful of others, we all wrote completely different music from each other and went into him, and he would give us guidance that was just, it was unmistakably just right dead on and quickly. He'd just read it, he'd hear it, he'd sight read transposed music. He had chops like crazy. And of course, one tends to idolize and idealize a teacher like that, perhaps, and perhaps my memory of it all is a little bit more golden than it was, but I don't think so, by the way. I mean, he was really impressive and gentle about it. I also remember on one occasion, I brought in a few of my big band charts, because I was still writing big band music. In fact, I had a big band at Juilliard, made up of students. And just out of curiosity, I thought, I'm going to bring this in. I said, would you mind, Dr. Persichetti? And he said, oh, no, no. And then I remember him talking about Lenny Tristano. He said, I don't know much about jazz, but I've listened to Lenny Tristano, and I really like him. And I remember thinking, well, that doesn't surprise me, because Tristano, if you know his playing, was especially angular and intervallically. I mean, you could hear Persichetti being very interested. There's a certain overlap of those two sensibilities. And sure enough, I brought my big band charts in, two or three of them, and he went through them with the same state of mind, of course, coming from the same place as he had all these classical pieces I'd written. He understood just what was going on. He didn't talk about the rhythm section and groove and certain kinds of things that jazz people would be more drawn to, nor the improv over chord changes, but he saw entirely what the, again, these sort of compositional truths, if you will, these verities that seem to be true for everything. Mm. And he tightened up my big band charts and said, that chord, where did that come from? It doesn't seem to, you know, I mean, he just had an eye and an ear for the minutiae that makes for an honest composition.
I'm so envious. That sounds great.
I'm so sorry that you didn't. So.
From Juilliard, then what happened after studying with him?
Well, oddly enough, though I revered and still do Persichetti, it was the semester that I studied with Luciano Berio when Persichetti was on a sabbatical that probably, ideologically at least, had the strongest influence on me. Berio had come for, I think, two semesters, of which I got to study with him for one. He and Kathy Berberian were guest artists during my time there, which is a beautiful coincidence and great blessing to have. They're wonderful as people. And I've always loved vocal music. I had also written songs as a kid. I was into Broadway, and I worked with a lot of singers, and I had set lots of poetry, Emily Dickinson and such, already at that time. And of course, Berio and Berberian, you know their work, I'm sure, and this whole idea of these abstract syllables and taking texts and breaking them into phonemes. Taking texts! Breaking. That kind of writing that he would do, that taking... I just fell in love with that stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote, this is how the Natural Sound Workshop occurred to me. I wrote a piece for, it was a smallish opera, and it was sort of in the style of Berio. It was one of these student pieces that you write that adulates your teacher and emulates him. And, you know, you don't know that at the time, but that's what it was, certainly. And I went to the opera department trying to get some people to perform it. And I couldn't get anyone, and they looked at the score. Every opera singer that I met was not conversant with this kind of notation. There was already graphic notation and stuff in it, and they were into Puccini and so forth. I realized when I looked at the sounds that I could probably teach them to anyone. Mm-hmm. That I myself had been singing that part while composing it the way you do, with all of its wide leaps, and there were cackles and barks and moans and sighs. And I thought, why do I even need a trained singer? And although Berberian, of course, and Gian Di Catani at the time, and several other of the sort of great lights of the avant classical repertoire, were highly disciplined with it. Suppose there were a rough-hewn version of it that were performed by non-singers. And of course, as a young composer, you're looking for yourself. What's my statement? How can I find my little alleyway that nobody else trod down yet? And I was also reading Buckminster Fuller and Cage. And in one of Fuller's books, there was this quote, I think it was Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth that this quote came from. And it said, specialization precludes comprehensive thinking. And he went on to talk about how we are a species of specialists. But if you only go to law school and learn to be a lawyer, or only go to science school, you can't think as a comprehensive being in the universe. It's just a brilliant insight, of course. He was a generalist and a populist. It was another way of saying, think outside of the box. Don't let yourself get, you know. And I remember brewing on that question and thinking, well, what's the music version of this? I'm a music specialist, everybody who has an education. I thought, well, suppose we get people who are not specialists and give them some comprehensive, quote unquote, some big overview of how sound works. And the light bulb one day went off in my head, I thought. And I remember that the phrase natural sound workshop also came to me for some reason in a little flash. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a workshop. Natural sound, just get people. Where am I going to find? So I put an ad on the back page of the Village Voice at the time, and sure enough, lots of phone calls. And I rented the then Dance Theater Workshop, which was on 19th Street, and I got 15 or 20 people showed up in the hippie era with long hair. This is my memory of that session, is that I was this very serious, I come from this serious Jewish intellectual family, and nobody had a sense of humor in my family, including me. Just everything was serious. I was a guy with a briefcase who had an idea, even in the hippie era, and I went in there with my idea. It was going to be serious music. What I was not prepared for was they had incredible fun. I taught them a low sound, middle sound, so high, and the slide, and the shake. I had invented all this stuff, and barking in all registers. And they're laughing and they're smiling, and it was like a party. And I thought, wow, man, this thing's even more attractive.
Let's pop out of the interview here and play a couple more cuts from the 1982 Natural Sound LP, starting with the Side One rhythm chant, and then Get Gone with Jay Clayton, soloist, on top of the Natural Sound Quintet, consisting of Michael Canick, Skip LaPlante, Michael Meadows, Kirk Nurok, and Claire Pitcher. The Natural Sound Ensemble on the album is Rebecca Armstrong, Hale Ost, Lefferts Brown, Michael Canick, Bob Casanova, Eva Charney, Serge Gubelman, Sony Moreno, Judy Nemac, Claire Pitcher, John Salmon, Narit Tillis, Sally Swisher, John Wise, and yours truly, Peter Wetzler. Which brings me to the fact that you are listening to Sound Forms Conversations with Composers, this month featuring Kirk Nurok with your host, Peter Wetzler. Thank you.
Thank you.
Apologies to Kirk for fading out on this beautiful piece, as I had to do with the Persichetti. But I can see now that the hour is three quarters over, that I'm only going to scratch the surface of your career in one show. This was from the 1990 Town Hall Concert with Marty Ehrlich on soprano sax and Kirk on piano. The piece is called Terrain, and I'm not sure if it had a commercial release. Before that, we heard Rhythm Chant, followed by Get Gone from the Natural Sound LP on Vergo Labor Records. Back to the interview.
Hadn't you cultivated a jazz rep as a pianist before that? What was your whole jazz piano career trajectory?
Jazz piano was the first thing that I learned, as I was saying before. My dad taught me as a child, and then he was the stage parent and put me on television. I had a local trio, sort of, was on the Merv Griffin show. We got all this footage and stuff of me as a kid. So I always played jazz piano, and then I wanted to write for a big band and did so. And I made a solo piano record in whatever that was, 73 or something, and gave a lot of solo piano concerts and worked with jazz people. I was also conducting Broadway shows. I was running around in all directions, trying to find myself as one does, but also trying to earn a living.
I'm going to jump ahead a bit in the interview to Kirk talking about the period in his career when he focused on interspecies music, writing pieces for dogs and chorus and instruments. We'll introduce that with the first movement of Expedition for Jazz Trio and Siberian Husky. Thank you. that was from the 1984 recording of the first movement of a four-movement piece for jazz trio and Siberian Husky called Expedition for Jane Ira Bloom, soprano sax. Harvey Schwartz was on bass, Kirk Nurok piano, Patty Hagen, animal facilitator, and Vega, the Siberian Husky. Now back to Kirk.
The animal stuff. But one of the reasons that I'm so proud of that period, and I still really like those pieces a lot, the actual music, is, and this is related to what you just said about the tonic, about the generation, the younger generation, and the fellow who went to the tonic, is that cross-species communication has started to bubble up, only in the last 4 or 5 years. For example, there's a course being taught at Columbia University called Animal Music. I know nothing about it, but someone sent me the little blurb. And even more significantly, and I wish that I had this exact fact to say, but on the cover of the New York Times book review section, maybe 5 Sundays ago, they thought enough of it to put it on the front page of that, someone wrote quite a thick tome about nature sounds and the musical content of nature sounds. And this man, whose name I wish I would, I gotta get this book. In fact, I even saw it in a store, but I was too busy and I didn't buy it. He was a member of the original Weavers, the folk group. That's who he was. And then he went on to become this something like an animal behaviorist who has toured the world for years now and then wrote this beautiful book that was exquisitely reviewed as a great breakthrough, blah, blah, blah. So my point is this idea of making music with animals, and as I used to always say also, it's not just animals, it's nature sounds, which is to say that it would include thunder and ocean sounds and so forth, that what I sometimes have found myself, if this doesn't seem too broad, what I've sometimes found myself referring to as God's orchestra. Because I really think of it that way, that the vastness of sounds and colors on this globe that are going on constantly in these what are called circadian cycles, which of course has to do with the seasons and the weather and it keeps changing, is exquisite and very untapped. It doesn't need to be tapped, it's nature, but very untapped from a compositional, contemporary music, analytical, and science point of view.
What did you learn about performing, or how to communicate with dogs, or how they communicated, or how did you see them connecting musically?
Parenthetically, I should give you, and I can probably print out some copies easily enough, 2 or 3 of my writings on this subject that answer mm-hmm. that quite in depth. On the one hand, I just have always loved animal sounds, the sounds as source material, in the same way that I came to love natural sounds of the humans, which is why, how and why it grew out of that. That when I had a chorus of people barking and howling, I thought that's a refreshing, passionate, kind of craggy, dark and wild, and humor-filled sound with the humans. I came to love those sounds of crowds, like even laughter, an outburst of laughter in a restaurant. If you listen to that as, quote, music, it's delightful. So simply having them in a composition of mine as an element seemed to be reason enough, without my having learned anything, necessarily. Mm-hmm. What had happened at that point in history is that, famously, George Crumb and Paul Winter both had already used humpback whale sounds and so forth as pre-recordings. I assume for the same reason, they were beautiful sounds. So you have the string quartet of Crumb, a famous work with the humpback whale. But it occurred to me that a next step that hadn't happened was to have it live. And being so much into improvisation and still traveling in jazz circles and knowing jazz players, and of course even the natural sound work, as you recall, was filled with improvisation. It was, virtually all of it were structured improvisations. Rarely was there an actual notated piece in any way. So the idea of putting an improviser opposite an animal and seeing what came out live in real time as opposed to a pre-record seemed irresistible. I think that no one had done that at the time, and so it almost didn't matter what was learned. It was just let's, in the truest spirit of experimentation, let's put them together and roll tape and let's see what comes out. So my first impetus was not so lofty as anything scientific or linguistic, etc. However, a lot was learned from that point onward. it seemed to me that certain, and I read a lot of Darwin and Leakey, I did an enormous amount of research, and one of the things that Darwin said is that in his experience, certain species seem to be more musical than others. He said birds, of course, but he said all birds. But in addition to birds, he said all the animals that derive from the wolf lineage seem to really enjoy making sound. And one of his observations was, of course, he studied them live up close, was that these animals, that what he said about wolves, this is a paraphrase, is that they, like all other species, seem to make sounds for survival reasons, danger, mating, hunger, there's content, there's meaning in it. But that wolves seem to also make sounds for no apparent reason other than the pleasure of making sound together, said he. I saw that, okay. And then he went on to say that those dogs that derive from the wolf family, I'll tell you what they are in a moment, also seem to have that trait. So it includes coyotes, which are wild, of course. You can't have a coyote on the stage.
German shepherds.
Yes, there we are. The obvious ones that you think. Siberian huskies, German shepherds, something called a Samoyed, which at the time I had not heard of, but is of the wolf lineage. And so I started advertising for those exact three breeds, as well as others. So I learned that, and then sure enough, as with humans, once I auditioned, I used to hold auditions, once I auditioned enough of them, I found that certain individuals were among, say, seven or eight Siberian huskies seemed more likely to be vociferous, as I used to put it, than others.
It's clear that I'm just going to have to return for another hour with Kirk to chat more and sample some of his choral music, his albums with Theo Bleckman, big band charts, and other facets of the music of Kirk Nurok. I think while the background noise of traffic and birds outside the window in this Chelsea apartment give a wonderful sense of place to the interview, perhaps I can talk Kirk into coming upstate for part two interview next year in my studio. So we're going to complete the interspecies portion of the interview with an excerpt from the 1980 recording of Howl for 20 voices and 3 canines. And that was from the 1980 recording of Howl for 20 voices and 3 canines by our guest this afternoon, Kirk Nurok. Next month, we'll either travel further downtown to the Duane Street loft of computer music pioneer and visionary Laurie Spiegel, or Woodstock-based expats currently living in Berlin, John Hodian and Bette Williams. You've been listening to Sound Forms with your host, Peter Wetzler.